Greetings, Mood Group friends, and welcome to another episode from Packaging Perspectives, brought to you by Mood Group. Now, today I have a very unique situation. Not only do I have a particularly significant and important guest on our show, but it's somebody that I have known probably as long as I've known most people, in as much as I'd like to introduce you to Sabir Sami, who is the ex-CEO of KFC, part of Yum Foods. And Sabir has recently retired and moved into consultancy. Sabir and I used to attend the same boarding school together in Malta many, many years ago. And we've kept in touch over all this time. And Sabir has a background in FMCG, marketing, food and beverages, and all packaging related, so it made sense to invite Sabir to give us some of his pearls of wisdom about what it's taken for him to get to the lofty heights that he did. So first of all, welcome Sabir, thank you for joining us.
Thanks Marcus, it's good to be here. And like you and I were chatting, I mean, it's crazy that we haven't met since 1984. It was almost like 41 years, but said we stayed in touch. So it's nice. And the fact that literally we grew up together as boys is incredible.
Exactly. And we were all around about 11 or 12 when we first joined. What age were you when you joined the school?
Yeah, around 11, 12. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, 11, 12, yeah. I think it was all year one for us. Sabir and I went to a boarding school in Malta. For those that don't know where Malta is, it's a small island off the North African coast or just off the Italian coast. We were expatriate children of parents that were predominantly working in Tripoli in Libya, I think, wasn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
You were Benghazi based, I think.
Yeah, Benghazi based, yeah.
Yeah, and I was Tripoli based. Mm. But both of us, I think, recognised that those early days of cultural appreciation and mixing and spending our lives, because we used to spend 3 months together, didn't we? Living and cohabiting and going to school and taking lessons and doing sports in the evenings and all sorts of things help prepare us for the international careers we've both had. So a little bit of a catch up then, Sabir. So after you finished at St. Edward's, 18 years old, all set to conquer the world, where did you go from there? What did you do? And let's have a bit of a catch up.
Sure, Marcus. You know, as you said, you know, pretty much I'm originally born in Pakistan, but, you know, left Pakistan when I was 2 years old, expatriate parents and the usual story in boarding schools. So as you said, you know, finished A levels 18 from St. Edward's, like you and I did it together. And then, you know, the normal route for many people would have gone to North America to go to university in the US or the UK. My father, for some reason, decided it's time to learn my own culture and language, neither of which I had any familiarity with. So basically, they decided to send me back home to Pakistan, which I think was, you know, at that time, I'm not sure I felt comfortable because it was almost like reverse culture shock, going back to your home country, but not knowing the language or the culture. But obviously, you know, now I identify myself as a Pakistani. I speak the language fluently and, you know, I feel at home over there. So I think it turned out well. Plus, I met my wife, which obviously was a big, big benefit and blessing as well. But I think, yeah, so anyway, went back to Pakistan, did my bachelor's and master's in business administration, graduated. I've worked very briefly at PepsiCo in operations. It was more like an internship, apprenticeship type of role, but very quickly joined Procter & Gamble, which was, you know, every graduate marketer's dream to work with a company like P&G as a brand manager. P&G did not exist in Pakistan, so they shipped us overseas to, a few of us were hired, five of us. I was one of the five, and we were shipped out to different parts of the P&G world. I went to Australia, to Sydney, to kind of do an accelerated kind of onboarding program for a year. And but during that time, the P&G business was registered and set up in Pakistan. Came back, worked with P&G for another 4 years in Pakistan, pretty much launching the business there as a brand manager, assistant brand manager. So a total of 5 years in P&G, then joined the Coca-Cola company in marketing, running the Pakistan business and a few countries around India. And then the big news was the embargo against American companies was lifted in Vietnam. So there was a race to get in, and I was asked to go to Vietnam as quickly as possible. Literally over the weekend, I flew to Vietnam to kind of launch Coca-Cola in a race against PepsiCo in Vietnam, which is a different conversation in itself. Went to Vietnam. In those days, Vietnam was very different than the Vietnam today. Nobody spoke English. There were few expats there only. It had just opened up recently. So a lot of restrictions and controls in place. But it was a great experience. Did that for, I'd say, around 9 to 12 months, in Ho Chi Minh, living in Ho Chi Minh.
Did your wife go with you as well?
No, they didn't issue visas for families. So, at that time, the restriction was very tight. It was only for work employees only. So it was a difficult decision because we just had a two-year-old at that time. And so my wife, Sarah, and he had to stay behind in Pakistan. And I got the notice to leave on, I was told that I need to be there, or I have the offer to go there on a Friday. And I flew out on a Sunday. I went to Bangkok on Sunday night. Picked up my visa on Monday morning in Bangkok from the Ho Chi Minh Vietnam Embassy. And then in the afternoon, I flew to Ho Chi Minh. And on Tuesday, I was at work there in Ho Chi Minh. And, my wife had to pack up house and shut down. And she had to relocate back to her parents in Karachi from Lahore. So it was more difficult for her than for me to manage all of that alone and with a two-year-old as well. But then after a year, I got promoted and moved to Singapore with the Coca-Cola company as the regional marketing head for Southeast Asia kind of region around 14 countries. And that's when my wife and my son joined us in Singapore, joined me in Singapore. Was there for 3 years in Singapore and running marketing for the region. And now I've done marketing for, 8 years, between P&G and Coke. And frankly, I just got bored in the sense that I wasn't learning anything. And I just felt I was doing more and more of the same. So I put my hand up and actually wrote a job description for a job that didn't exist at the bottler end. I went to the bottler president and I told him, you need this role. And I was working for the company, not for the bottler. And it was more like a kind of a marketing operations role at the bottler. And he looked at the CV and he's like, yep, you're right. This is a key job that we're missing, but who's going to do this job? And I said, I volunteer. So I'll
come across. What was the job?
What was like the job? Marketing. So what was happening was I was basically kind of, my team and I were running marketing and brand strategy promotions for the Coca-Cola company, for the brand Coke, Fanta, Sprite. But none of it was actually translating into execution in the stores. So it was running on advertising. But when you get into the store level, the consumer experience, the consumer visibility, what the consumer saw and bought and experienced wasn't there. Right. And I felt there was a disconnect between what the brand promise was and what the brand execution was. And execution is done by the bottler. And the bottler staff were really focused on the sales and distribution. They weren't focused on merchandising. They weren't focused on making it, which package should be at which part of the store and what experience and where should it go. So that really was the job. And it was 14 countries. So we're looking at Vietnam, Singapore, Malaysia, Brunei, Sri Lanka, Bangladesh, Cambodia. Anyway, so I wrote the job description and I volunteered for the role. And I think I was one of the few people ever who's gone from the company to the bottler. Most people want to go from the bottler to the company. So I was seconded from the company to the bottler. And I did that role for a year. And again, I think it was because I wanted to do something different. I wanted to learn, not knowing that I was going down a rabbit hole, because then next thing I knew is the opportunity opened up for a plant manager role at Coca-Cola. In Pakistan, southern Pakistan. And, somehow, I don't even remember how the conversations ended up, but I became a plant manager for 3 Coca-Cola bottling plants. So, which was a complete change because, my entire experience was marketing, which is about, meeting agencies, shooting ads, discussing strategies. And, a year and a half later, I found myself actually getting up in the morning and talking about carbon coolers and ammonia compressors and bottle washers and forklift maintenance issues and, what quality control does the sugar have? And, what's the food in the cafeteria for the plant employees and things like that? And literally, I spent not a single hour talking about marketing or brand positioning because, I was just fighting fires in the plant and getting things done. But the learning curve was incredibly steep. It was just something completely different that I have no education on. And most plant managers come from an engineering or a kind of, production kind of background. My entire experience was marketing. But again, like I said, you know, learning about collective bargaining agreements and negotiations with unions, learning about distribution, logistics, production planning, capacity planning, maintenance, equipment, all of that was fantastic. Did that for a couple of years, and then a company called Reckitt Benckiser came along, which used to be known as Reckitt and Coleman before. They got merged with Reckitt Benckiser, and long story short, they hired me as the CEO for Pakistan.
Was that through a headhunter or executive search or something?
Yeah, executive search. I can't even remember who it was that called me. I went through a couple of rounds of interviews with different people in Dubai and Singapore. I joined as the CEO for Pakistan. It was a fairly large business in Pakistan, around 5,000 employees, 5 factories, something like around 14 or 15 brands, from laundry to polishes to pest control to air fresheners and so forth. Worked with them for 3 years in Pakistan and running the business. And then 9/11 happened. And 9/11 became very difficult as a international executive in Pakistan with a Pakistani passport. I found that I couldn't travel freely, visas were getting restricted. More than for myself, I really didn't want my boys to go through something like that in their career or in their kind of pursuit of whatever they chose to do. So my wife and I decided that, look, it's time to immigrate. And, the company record was fantastic. They helped me, talk to the governments of UK, Australia, US, and Canada. And Canada was the fastest. They said, look, happy to get him to come here, get his residency, and then move on to kind of more of a guaranteed path. So we moved here in 2003 with the Reckitt, and I came, and it was interesting because I was the general manager, the head of the business in Pakistan. I had to come to Canada. I had to take a step down. Yeah. The GM position for Canada was already taken. So the company said, look, we have a marketing director position, but we don't have the GM position. So we'll get you to the GM as quickly as we can, but that's all we can offer you. And I was fine with it because to me, this was a life decision about, the future of my children. It wasn't really about a career choice.
Yeah.
And it turned out.
Can I just ask on that point, Sabir, were you running a manufacturing plant in Pakistan or was it more of a sales and distribution?
No, they had five plants. So okay. Polishes, laundry, pest control, two pharmaceuticals. One was OTC and one was prescription drugs. So the prescription one had more tighter controls on manufacturing facility, kind of hygiene standards and so forth as well.
And did you find yourself going from, so in the bottling plant at Coca-Cola, which was probably pure straight line single product, now you're back into a diversity of products. Did that take you back more into marketing and promotion as well?
Yeah, because I became GM CEO, right? So Reckitt was like, I had a head of manufacturing, head of marketing, there was sales and distribution. We had HR, and there was also the Pakistan business for Reckitt in that time. I don't know what it is today, but at that time, 51 or 52% was owned by Reckitt PLC, and 48% was listed on the stock market in Pakistan. So we also had external shareholders, AGMs, board meetings, and so forth. So it was an interesting learning where I could leverage the experience from P&G and Coke on marketing and branding. The Coca-Cola bottling experience plant came really handy in running the plants and understanding all the plant issues. But then there was new learning about the legal and regulatory affairs regarding pharmaceuticals, external shareholders, board management, compliance, and so forth as well. So that was really good. And again, I was only 32 at the time. So it was like, I was drinking from a fire hose and trying to understand how to be a CEO of a publicly kind of listed company with manufacturing plants and 5,000 employees at the age of 32. So it was really kind of very, very new for me. But, I had really good counselors and advisors and teachers who helped me along the way. And we can go back to any of these as you wish to later on. I'm just going to get through the timeline for today. Came to Canada, and I think I came as marketing director, and I think that was really good because, I never worked in the Northern Hemisphere. So the trade structure is very different, right? You've got, like in the UK, you've got Sainsbury's and Tesco's and these big players. in Pakistan, Vietnam, Singapore. It's almost like the local mom and pop grocery stores down the street, right? So I'd never dealt with the Walmarts of this world, right? So coming as the GM would have been, whoa, a big, big shock. Coming as a marketing director allowed me to come under the radar and learn how consumers operate differently, how the trade operates here differently. I mean, I did that for 3 years. And then the general manager, Heather, she was promoted and she moved to the UK to the head office. And I took over the GM role. And I did that for 3 more years until Jan came along. And again, through a recruiter. And, you know, I went and met them. And I have to admit, I said no, because I didn't know anything about the food business. I didn't know anything about the quick service restaurant. I was, you know, my entire life had been FMCG. I knew that business really well. Didn't know anything about restaurants, never worked in a restaurant before. But I give them credit. They came back after 6 months again, more persistent. And then I went to Louisville to meet with David Novak, the CEO and chairman of Yum. And I have to admit, David blew me away. You know, I mean, he's the key reason I joined Yum. You know, his leadership, his kind of charisma, his energy and passion were outstanding and still is to this day, to be honest. So I joined Yum as the president of Canada. That time, you know, running KFC, Pizza Hut, and Taco Bell. For 4 years, I was doing that role. And then Yum acquired the franchise rights back from the franchisee in Turkey for KFC and Pizza Hut. And they approached me to go to Turkey and run the business there. And this was, Canada was a franchise market. Turkey would have been equity market. So I was really now back again into, like, you know, corporate stores. So my wife and I then, you know, we moved to Istanbul, and which was something we did not plan to do, because we'd come to Canada to kind of make a home, but the opportunity was too good to pass up. Istanbul was always like one of those kind of mystical, fun places to go to. But again, we couldn't speak the language, didn't know anything about the place, but, you know, we said, you know what, let's just jump in. So we moved to Istanbul and we were there for 4 years. Then again, the company restructured globally and Turkey became part of the restructuring. We spun off the business and it became part of the North Africa, Middle East region. So then we moved to Dubai, running that region for another 3 years total. The last two of which I also took responsibility for Asia, not Pacific, not Australia, which included India all the way up to, you know, Japan and the Southeast and West Asia regions. And then my wife and I decided that, you know, after so many moves, we lost some parents as well by this time. So we just decided that it's time to come home and put some roots down. So anyway, I decided to come back to Canada and the company offered me the role of chief operating officer for KFC, global COO, which again, you know, I'm not an operations person. My background is marketing / general management. To become the chief operating officer role was a bit unusual, but you know, I do believe in the passion. I firmly believe about the fact that operations ultimately is the key success. You can develop decks and presentations and plans, but if the execution of the brand promise doesn't get done through operations, it doesn't really matter. So you know, I really carried that passion and commitment to operations to the role more than the knowledge. And I was, right. I was kind of telling the COOs around the world, I said, look, you know operations far better than I do. I'm here to give you a stage and to give you a voice and a platform. That's really my role. I did that for a couple of years, but you know, that was through COVID, right? So it was really tough. You couldn't travel. We were all working through Teams. So it was a bit of a weird to be chief operating officer and never visit the stores, but It was what it is. There was no choice. And then in 2021, the KFC.
And mind you, you must have had a different operating challenge as well during COVID, because deliveries became a big thing, didn't they? Rather than picking and collecting.
I mean, you know, we had to switch to contactless payment. And I remember to this day, the KPI or the result, we switched around 28,000 stores to contactless payment in 11 days. You know, it was just incredible. It just shows you that when there's no choice, what people are capable of doing. You know, if I asked us to switch to contactless payment, it would probably taken us 3 years to do, right? But the fact that there was no other alternative, then you find a way, things get done. Anyway, then 2021, the then CEO retired, and Yum asked me to take over as brand CEO, and did that. Loved the job, loved the people. Didn't expect the role at all, but it was a privilege to run the business and work for the people who constitute KFC around the world, the franchisees. And then early this year, I just felt that after 13 moves across 5 continents and 36 years of work life, it was time to kind of spend time with the family. But now we have 2 grandkids. They live nearby as well. So I just wanted to be more at home rather than traveling. I was traveling almost 200 days a year. And having done that for 4 or 5 years, it gets difficult, it gets tiring. The business was in a great place. They had a very strong successor ready to step in as well. So it was right for me personally, and I think right for the business as well. And here we are today.
Well. Thank you very much. It's for anyone that's looking at your profile and thinking, how did he do that? You've just explained it amazingly, and thank you very much. And I suppose, does it not serve as a illustration as well, that if I'm somebody more junior in my career, looking at some of these big jobs, thinking, oh, I might not ever be able to get that, you prove that you can. You prove that with the right can-do attitude, the right, like you say, with Vietnam, being willing to jump in and do something. And
yeah, I mean, look, at the end of the day, you take any CEO around the world or any senior leader around the world, they all started at the age of 21, 22 in the junior role. Nobody was born into this position. Yeah, of course, if you have a family business, it might be different. But most people in most corporate roles started at the junior level, and then they got promoted and they got more responsibility. So, can anybody do it? Absolutely. The question is application, opportunity, take some risks, have the courage to do what needs to be done, have the discipline. There's a whole bunch of factors that you need to there's no doubt about it that I was blessed and I was lucky. But I also took the risks that were necessary as well. And took some of the tough roles that were needed as well, that gave you the experience. And it was not linear. Like I said, I stepped down from GM back to marketing again. I went, and when I went to plant manager, when I was marketing director for Southeast Asia, I was flying around, meeting agencies, shooting commercials. I was a plant manager. I didn't get on a plane for a year. I mean, all I was doing is going to the plant and dealing with machinery and oil and trucks and, but I don't regret it. It was fun. It was incredible fun, right? Mm-hmm. What I'm trying to say is career is not linear. I think it's a journey, but what it has to be linear, or at least upward trajectory, is the fact that you're learning and you're growing, right? I think that's important. The day you stop learning or growing, I think that's when you need to kind of get agitated and say, look, I need something different. But as long as you're growing and learning, the experiences could be tough, could be easy, could be different and varied, and all of them are good.
Yeah, it's a very important thing, because I heard you say earlier on in the conversation, when you made a change, you said, I wasn't learning. You'd reached the point where that seemed to be, in a couple of cases, like a traffic light for you, wasn't it? Am I stopping learning? Am I not developing? Am I not changing myself? Okay, so I've got to do something about that.
And then the learning with 2 types, right? One is on the job learning, where you get in and you're like, oh my God, I don't know this thing. So you start trying and experimenting and learning. But when I became a plant manager for Coca-Cola, the technical production manager, he'd been, he was like a deep, hardcore engineer and been with the business for almost 30, 35 years. So every Thursday afternoon, I would ask him to sit down with me for an hour and teach me about one piece of equipment. All right. So, take carbon coolers. Okay, what is a carbon cooler? Why does it operate? What are the breakdowns? What's the major issues with it? What does it cost? Who are the major manufacturers? And we did that item by item throughout the whole plant, right? Every Thursday afternoon, right? So it was like reverse mentoring, perhaps reverse coaching, where I was the boss, but I was telling him, teach me so I can help you do your job as well. And similarly, when I became GM for the Reckitt PLC, for the Reckitt Pakistan business, which had, you know, public shareholders and all that, you know, I had a family person who in the family who had been a senior banker. So I asked him to teach me. I said, okay, as a banker, what do you look for? You know, I didn't know about things like debt asset ratios and about, you know, dividend yields and, you know, loan, you know, facilities and all that, because I was a marketer. I didn't know all of this stuff, right? So again, I asked him to teach me formally. So I think there's learning on the job, but then also you step away and you kind of get very, very conscious, structured learning as well.
And you demonstrate and prove that if you're not afraid to do that, if you're not hesitant to say, I don't know something and go and look for the answers, where it can take you, rather than some people who might get into a certain position where they think that entitles them to have some sort of superiority complex. You know, I know everything, I'm, you know. And that's so dangerous and so worrying, isn't it?
It's funny you say that. I was talking to somebody recently, and I don't know how the example came up, but I remember when I was CEO of KFC maybe a year ago, I had a team of like around 15, 25 directors and vice presidents in a room, and they were presenting a plan to me about a strategy that we wanted to adopt. And the presentation finished, and then they turned to me, and I said, yep, I'm on board, let's go. And there was a kind of a silence in the room. And I think, and I said, you know, okay, so now what? What's going on? And they said, no, we're waiting for you to give your input, right? And I said, I have nothing better to add than what you've done. You know, you guys are the best in class in this stuff. You know the answers better than I will ever do. There's nothing that I can add that's going to improve the workings or the presentation or the proposal that you've got. So guys, go with it. You know, all I'm doing is approving it and supporting you guys. So I think there is this kind of corporate kind of perspective sometimes, or the arrogance sometimes of leaders to think, you know what, I always need to have the final word. I always need to add my pearls of wisdom. And yes, quite often you do. But quite often, maybe you just have the humility to say, you know what, no, you know, you guys know better, you know, and normally they do. People who are closer to the issues, they know better. Now, you may have a different perspective from your past life or other things, or you may have knowledge that, so you can add that to improve it. But it's not every time the case. But there is, I've met and seen leaders who need to have the final word, you know, who need to kind of feel to say that, okay, if I haven't added value to this, then, you know, I've not done my job. And perhaps your value is best in supporting the team rather than telling the team what to do.
Yeah. I remember once, actually, fairly early on in my career, somebody, you talk about having David as somebody who blew you away and brought you on. I had some heavy influence early on in my career. And I used to go to him with problems. And one day he said, he stopped me as I came in through the office, and he said, this isn't a magic chair, Marcus. He said, you know, next time you come in with the solution as well, please, you know, and then we'll talk about it.
Yeah, and I think that's the difference between a manager and a coach as well, right? I mean, a manager will tell somebody what to do. A coach will let the employee learn and grow and figure it out. I always tell people the analogy that when you see a football match, the coach doesn't run onto the field and start playing the game, right? The players stay on the field, the coach stays on the side. And I think great leaders are coaches that stay on the side and allow the players the ability to learn for themselves, but also have the ability to kind of pull the player aside and say, hey, look, this is the wrong play that you're making. This is what you need to do. Not actually get on the field and start playing it, right? Because your job is to look at the whole field and the whole team, not get into one position and play that position, because then you lost the perspective of how the team is kind of playing together.
Very good analogy, Sabit. Very good. I like that. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. What you referred to David and he blew you away. So what role did he carry on playing in your career path after he persuaded you to be there?
Yeah, I mean, look, David, first of all, he set the culture and the tone of the organization, right? And, you know, all of us as leaders in the business kind of then, once you what do you call it? You also feel that you belong and you subscribe to that philosophy, those values, then you also want to lead by example as well. So he led the way. He showed us how to treat people, how to balance people and results. And, you know, he always just say people first, results follow. And that mantra is so powerful, and it's something that I've always believed as well. If you take care of the people, they will take care of the results, right? And as a leader, that's the best thing that you can do. And then, you know, as I onboarded with Yum and I kind of, you know, stayed with the company for a while, David was around for another, I think, 5 to 6 years when I joined. So yeah, those regular calls with David, he would take the time to reach out, you know, check in how things are going. And he was the CEO and I was running Canada. So between him and me, there were three levels, but David had the ability to reach out. But I think, you know, the other thing about that, you know, when you go through life and you have some great leaders, great bosses, perhaps not so good ones. I was really blessed to have some really good managers who you always hope to emulate, you know, because they showed you and they made you feel different and special. And, you know, from my early days in P&G Australia to my days in Singapore, and then obviously, you know, what I saw with David as well, I've had some really, really good managers who, like I said, showed me how to do it. So, yeah, that was a big blessing for me, and I was lucky to have that.
Yeah, it's amazing how people can play parts, and sometimes not even a huge thing, but it's a small thing that becomes a life-changing thing that you never forget, do you?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, people say this all the time, it's not what you do, but how you make people feel that's important. When you're on the receiving end of how you feel and you remember how that emotion is inside you, then you know, right? And then and that's something that you try to do with other people as well. And I think it also sensitizes your emotional radar on other people, because the fact that you care, then your radar is on. You're looking to see how people are feeling. Whereas, you know, I have seen managers completely oblivious to how their team sentiments and mood is, go into a room, bark some orders and leave, and not realizing that the team is really not on board. You know, you really don't have their hearts, they don't have that commitment on it, right? Just because their radar is not reading the room at all.
Yeah, they're blundering into it, aren't they? If you were, if you know, if they say a successful man is known by the number of mistakes he makes, or successful person, sorry, not man. So inevitably, there will have been some things that you might have said, oh, with the benefit of hindsight, I might do differently. Any of those you want to share, Sarbit? Anything?
Yeah, I'm sure. Look, from a business standpoint, I think, you know, I'm sure there are many, right? I think, yeah, I mean, I can't remember the name. I won't mention specific names or whatever, but, you know, for example, a hiring mistake, right?
Yeah.
Right. You interview somebody and you feel in your instinct that this person is not a right fit for the role, right? But the role is an important one. It's vacant. You desperately need the person. So you compromise and you're like, you know what? Okay. Not perfect, but you know what? I'll go with it. I'm sure the person will fit in. I'll coach this person or whatever, right? And I've always lived to regret it. You know, whenever I felt that this person was not the right fit. And again, I'm not saying they were a bad person. It's the fit issue, right?
So, yeah.
And in every time my alarm bells have rung inside and I've gone against it, I've come to regret it, right? So more and more with time, I've learned to trust my instincts. Having said that, even as the KFC CEO, I was still making people mistakes, recruiting mistakes. Because you're making, like, you're hiring 30, 40 people a year across the world, you know, and you interview somebody and, you know, you kind of, anyway. So that was, I think that's one thing that I do regret. And it's not good for the company when you make a hiring mistake, but it's even worse for the poor individual, because that person is doing fairly well in that role wherever they're working. They've left that career, come to you, and 6 months later or a year later, unfortunately, you have to part ways. It's not good for anybody. So, and to be honest, that to me is worse than any business decision, because this affects people, their lives, their families. So I think that's one thing that I've learned to be careful about. And I've had more than my fair share of mistakes. What else? Yeah, early on in my career, you know, I was trying to make a proposal or recommendation for something that I really believed in. And when I had done all the, and I believed so passionately in it that I stopped seeing the cons of the strategy, right? And I had been so vocal about the strategy that I was more committed publicly than I needed to be. So when I actually wrote the proposal, I actually kind of played down the risks in the proposal and I played up the strengths of the proposal. Luckily, I had a boss who was smart enough and good enough to kick my ass and catch me on it, right? And I've learned ever since then to kind of be very, very factual and, you know, or just keep the passion out of the rational. You can still be passionate about something, but look at data for what it's truly worth and then have the vulnerability and the humility to say, you know what, I was passionate, but you know what, based on data, I need to pull back. The problem is that, you know, so I learned that lesson early on. This problem is that when you become a senior leader and you have passion for what you do, when you combine the rank and the passion, it can be intimidating to people. Because then they're saying, oh, wait a minute, you know, he's the general manager or he's the managing director. You know, and he believes in this thing. He really wants this thing, right? So then what you create is an atmosphere where people feel scared to tell you the truth. And the truth may be something that you don't want to hear, but it's the truth nonetheless, right? So I've tried in my life to kind of temper that and be open and kind of give people the space. Now, people who are close to me, who work close to me, they know me well enough to say, look, you know, Sabir, you're wrong. This is a mistake. Don't do it. But the people who don't know me, and they know me more through my rank and my title rather than me as a person, there the problem does exist, you know, where I think the passion that I have for the business or for a project together with my rank can be intimidating. And I got that feedback throughout my entire life that, you know what, you need to tone it down. You need to allow people to approach you a bit more as well. But unfortunately, we are who we are. So, you know, I tell people sometimes that you cannot change who you are. You can try to have coping mechanisms. You can try to work at it. But what I have learned is that the more you tell people honestly, look, to say, look, this is who I am, right? And this is the flaws that I have. And thereby you give people, first of all, people see you as a human being. Just like everybody else, none of us is perfect. And secondly, it also tells people to give them the permission to say, look, I'm giving you permission to call me out, right? Yeah. Please do so. And again, it requires vulnerability and courage to do so. It's not easy because, as you said, the expectation is, hey, you're a senior leader. You must have it all done. You have to know all the answers, you know, and it's not true. You know, I think many senior leaders don't have the answers, and, you know, it's scary when they think that they do.
But isn't that why a lot of successful companies have boards of experts? Because you can basically, through the right profiling, you can put your dream team together, can't you? And you can say they're very inclined to that, they're very not inclined to that. But once we assemble them together and bring in strategy and appraisal that way, we get everybody's good bits and the other bits rub off.
Yeah, I think, look, great leaders, great CEOs are the ones who basically assimilate a group of executive team and a board above them of, you know, people from varied backgrounds, experiences, and create a trust in that ecosystem to give honest feedback, because you want to hear it from your team, because the team is the one who need to execute it. And the board has a kind of a broader view. And, you know, different executives, different experiences, different skill sets as well. So, yeah, great leaders and CEOs do that. But if they don't, you know, and you create a community of yes men or yes women around you, then it can get very, very dangerous very quickly, where they're eager to please and they think that their job is to work for the person and not for the organization.
Exactly, yeah. And they don't challenge. And you get, if you get autocratic management and autocratic thinking, it can kill a company, can't it?
Absolutely.
So it kind of moves the conversation on to the future, and talking on the topic of assembling, you know, experience is neither inheritance nor legacy, as we say in an English proverb. You bring a combination of talented people together, or a particular person on a particular project. I now know that you've retired from KFC, but you now have your own advisory business, which we've talked about, where you get the opportunity to bring that perspective and that wisdom in and help people. What are you excited about for the future with that respect? What are you looking forward to? Was there any time you ever used to step back from or look back from what you were doing on a day-to-day basis and think, I'd love to go into that business sector or that business sector or that business sector with my expertise that I have? Is there anything that's tickling your fancy?
The honest answer is no. At the time when I was in the corporate role, to be honest, I mean, I was all consumed, and I loved, and I still love, you know, the KFC community, the brand, the business, the people. So that was not, and when I retired, that was not part of the plan to, I didn't really think about the future. I really wanted to spend time taking a few months with the family, play golf, hang out with my grandkids, you know, read the books that I wanted to read, that type of stuff. And that was really what I've been doing for the last 6 months. It was only in the last few weeks, and actually it's my sons to blame for this. They're the ones who've been pushing me and saying, look, you know, you should think about consulting or advising or whatever, something given your experience and given your background. Obviously, other people, friends, have also said the same thing. But, you know, when you get in the family, then it's a constant, you know, and my sons, both of them have push. And I said, okay, fine, guys, you know, I'm happy to kind of think about this. Now that I've started it, you know, I mean, I am, to be honest, I mean, humbled by the people who reached out already very quickly within a week and asked for some support or help or conversations. And I'm happy to do all of that. Where it will go, I'm not too sure, to be honest. Right. And I don't know where I can be of value. You know, I mean, my experiences is predominantly in FMCG, QSR, but also in leadership, people development, team kind of structures and organization turnarounds. But, you know, commercial and marketing operations is all things that I've done in the past. I'm very, very familiar with things like that. And then geographical international, right? I worked in Australia, Vietnam, Singapore, run Asia, Middle East, based in Dubai, traveled to, I don't know, 75 countries in my life. And, you know, from all the way down to markets like Argentina, all the way up to, you know, Poland and so forth, right? It's Russia. So I think it's international experience, as we talked about, cultural kind of, ability to kind of understand and respect and love international different cultures, diversity. So to be honest, I don't have an agenda as such, right? I'm just very, very open. Now, whether it's consulting, advising, board, whatever it might be, it's fine. You know, it's all good. I'm not really hungry for anything specific either. And we'll see what life brings, to be honest. That's the fun part of being retired. You don't really need to have a plan. You can take it as it comes one day at a time.
I think also it's like that classic thing, isn't it? When you stop looking for something, or you stop being that premeditated, you by releasing something, you let something else come in, don't you?
Yeah.
Which otherwise may not have been there. If you were to distill some of the ingredients that you think served you well, and you were to say to other people, I'm not necessarily saying this is do what I do and it will get the same results, but if you were to say anything that you think quite passionately about that people should embody or remember to activate or whatever, what would you say?
Oh, that's a good question. I hate telling people what to do because it sounds arrogant, and you know what worked for me doesn't necessarily may not work for everybody.
Yeah,
but I can only
that's
share.
That's why I caveated it that way. You know, but things that you found, you know, that the things that were, you know, always be early or always this or always that.
Yeah, you know, when I was the GM for the Pakistan business, and then I came to Canada as well, what I discovered was that when you are in an operating role, the moment I get to the office till the time I left the office, I was in back-to-back meetings. or just catching up on email or scrambling to see somebody and close a conversation or whatever. And it was really like, you know, nonstop, right? And as a result of that, most of my time was being spent on reactive initiatives, right? Reacting to things. And I can't remember when it was, but it was, I think, around 1999 or 2000 when I caught myself and I said, look, wait a minute, I'm not actually driving this ship, right? I'm just another passenger running around the levels or trying to figure out whether it's the engine room or the bridge or whatever I need to fix. And I started a habit then that I never stopped, right, until the day I retired or the week I retired, which basically was that on Saturday morning when the office was shut down, and those days I was to go to the office, Saturday morning, I'm an early riser, so around 7 o'clock, I would basically put on jeans and a t-shirt and I would go to the office. And I would not turn on my computer and I would actually get onto the whiteboard and I would start doodling and start thinking. And I would think about, like, you know, okay, what are the things that I should be worried about that I'm not worried about? Who are the people that I, on my team, in my stakeholders, that I've not spent time with that I should, right? Who don't I know how they're feeling? What are the things that are over the horizon that I'm not worried about that I should be thinking about as the leader of the business? Always used to assess the business from supply chain, from, you know, suppliers all the way through to customers and everything in between, and say, where are my weak points? Where are my strengths? Is it in supply chain base? Is it diversified? Is it solid? Are they financially stable? Is it distribution, warehousing, manufacturing, all the way through to, you know, customers at the end? Each experience, where is it, right? And then also do the same thing on the axis of P&L as well, right? Depending on different product lines, you know, where's the top line growth? Where's my cost structure? Where's my overheads? Where's my profit margins? And so forth. So looking at every business in that way. So even when I was running a plant, I would be doing it that way, all the way to when I became global CEO for KFC. I would look at different geographies, different franchisees, different businesses around the world, different teams. So is it the MENA team, looking at the Africa team? You know, where do we need to spend the time? And then during that kind of thinking time, and it was on a piece of paper on a whiteboard, never on the computer, so it was actually physical writing it down. Out of that, I would start taking notes on the side and start saying, ah, okay, I need to spend time with so-and-so leader. I need to think about this supplier. I need to, you know, I need to go and visit this warehouse, or I need to go and look at the quality experience of this product or whatever. And those 4 or 5 points I would just capture and I would erase everything then off that. And then those 4 or 5 things I would sit down on my calendar and I would make sure that they were put on my calendar for the next couple of weeks or whatever the time frame was necessary. So to make sure that I get to it and get it done. And I started that, like I said, around 2000, and I've done it ever since. Every single Saturday, I do that exercise, right? And it actually, what it does is it just keeps bringing me back to base, back to focus on what my priorities need to be, where should I be spending my time, so that I became in charge of my schedule and my time rather than reacting to other people's things. And once things get on my diary, on my calendar, then they happen. But you need to make space for it. And my calendar and diary, rather than getting populated by other people's priorities, they were being populated by my priorities, what I needed to get done. Now, of course, you have space to meet other people, but at least you have that organization structure. Later on in life, you know, and then I would be home by around 9 o'clock. So it was leave at 7, an hour or two of this, be back home at 9. You know, go to the office, kick my shoes off and do this doodling and thinking and walking and writing. And then I think around 10 years ago, I managed to have an office at home. So I don't need to drive to the office anymore. I just go into my office with a cup of coffee and I sit here and I do it here on a white sheet of paper. But I found that, you know, and people talk about scheduling thinking time. Maybe this is an elaborate way of saying the same thing. But I find that, you know, so many managers and individuals don't take the time to do this. And they're just running from pillar to post, from guardrail to guardrail, from crisis to crisis, rather than saying, hey, what's my role? What should I be focused on? What's happening in my kind of realm of the business? Or what should I be focused on? So I just found that extremely powerful for me personally. And the fact that I was doing it every single week, you know, just kept bringing me back to core priorities again and again and again. So I don't know if that's useful to other people, but I found that very, very kind of, you know, powerful for me.
I think it is, Sabir. I think it's a real nugget there. And the fact that you were stepping away from the noise, I think, you know, the Monday to Friday noise, and saying, okay, I'm partitioning some of my private time, which actually I'm awarded because of what I do anyway. So it's interlinked in a fashion, because there are some people nowadays, we come across it where there's this mindset, and I'm slightly frightened that it's not so much from yours or my generation, but from some other generations, where it's kind of, oh no, I'm not doing that then, you know, and it's not making the investment, is it?
And yeah, and look, and
that will be your mediocre manager. That won't be your future CEO of KFC. Yeah.
And look, I would tell people all the time, I think the 9-to-5 working hours is something I don't believe in, right? 9-to-5 came from the Industrial Revolution, when people needed to go to the factory, clock in, work the shift, and then leave. We work, and the digital revolution has come in. How many of us carry our cell phones around with us and send emails on the weekend or late nights? So yeah, okay, there's hours when we need to be together to have strategy and meetings. But, you know, there's clear learning now that some people work better in the morning, some in the evening, and so forth. So this is not a case about sacrificing Saturday. I think it makes the rest of your entire week more effective and more focused. So actually you gain back time. Mm-hmm. So before I was doing this, because I was being reactive, I was getting home at 9 and 10 at night every night on the Monday to Friday. After having these Saturday morning sessions and my time became more focused, I actually managed to get home at 6 o'clock, right? Yeah. So actually you gain time as a result of this. And it's the old adage of better planning the results and more effective execution. That's really what it is. Yeah. But I think for many of us as executives, we just caught up in you hit the office and boom, you know, everything starts, right? And you just don't take the time to think about it. And I think for me, doing that just worked. Like I said, I'm not suggesting or recommending. I'm just saying what worked for me, and it's up to people to decide whatever they want to do. I've had people tell me, okay, I'm going to do that on the Monday morning, or I'll do that on the Friday afternoon. I found it doesn't work, because if you're at your desk, people will interrupt you. People will come in, and you'll have to be either polite and say, yes, okay, and interrupt your thinking, or you have to be impolite and say, no, sorry, I'm not available. Both of which is a compromise to your ability to get this thing done, right? So for me, I just found it like Saturday morning. And I'm not suggesting everybody goes to the office. Find a quiet coffee shop near your house. Go there and do this. Sit at your dining table if you need to. Put some headphones on, close the door, whatever. But yeah, just spend some time thinking. And not enough people do that as well.
Do you remember that old poster or sign there used to be? I remember seeing it years ago. I'll tone the language down a bit, but it says something along the lines of, when you're up to your backside in alligators, it's difficult to remind yourself that your initial obligation was to drain the swamp.
Yeah, exactly.
And yeah, you're fighting fires and dealing with this crisis and that crisis. You're not getting that perspective. But it's what pearls of wisdom. And clearly, it worked. Clearly, yeah, you know, it worked. So, yes, on behalf of our audience, thank you very much. On behalf of the audience, you know, it's classic. We're not saying it's a definitive thing, but use it or don't use it kind of thing.
That's your description, yeah, absolutely.
And so, Sabir, we've monopolized enough of your time today. Thank you very much from Mood Group and from the people that follow this podcast. I'm sure somebody somewhere is going to gain something from what you've shared with us today. And if we affect one person's life, that's fantastic. If it's more than that, brilliant. We have a global audience of people around the world who will learn. And that classic thing, you don't know what you don't know. Well, now they do know what you did. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Marcus. A pleasure. And yeah, nice to reconnect again after so many years. Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome.